Action for the Nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of IRN, its advertisers, or affiliates.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for this next hour, they're going to be your views as well, because this is Open Line Wednesday, and certainly our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, and if you don't call in, why, it'll be a long, long, difficult hour. But anyway, I thought maybe we'd start out telling you the story of Sybil Edmonds, which is the subject of my January newsletter. And, of course, the name Sybil Edmonds is probably known to people who read the Internet, but not known to the average individual. There have been a few articles about her in the regular media about the fact that she did have a lawsuit, that she'd been a translator for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And apparently Sybil was actually employed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation shortly after the 9/11 attack, and she was supposed to translate all these wiretaps that the FBI had made before the 9/11 attack. And, of course, she made a number of interesting discoveries, which she was allowed to talk about, and one of them was the fact that the FBI knew that the attack was coming. Amazingly enough, one of the Iranians that actually defected to the United States and told them the attack was coming and they were going to use airplanes to attack the United States. So the FBI knew it was going to happen, and of course nothing was done to stop the attack. But of course the most significant thing that she discovered was that there was a woman who was actually working with her as a translator, was translating Turkish. Now, of course, Sybil is fluent in Arabic and in Farsi, but this woman was translating the Arabic wiretaps, and this woman was actually deleting important things, especially when they dealt with one Turkish intelligence officer. And, of course, then eventually she threatened Sybil when Sybil mentioned this and said that, you know, she should be reporting these things. These were very important. And, in fact, the woman tried to recruit Sybil into a subversive organization. Her name was Jan Dickerson. And, well, eventually, of course, Sybil's family was threatened, and she went, of course, to her superiors and reported this, and it was a terrible thing. And then they fired Sybil. They fired her for reporting this and reporting somebody who was certainly almost working like a spy for the FBI. And, well, this is a long and detailed study. You're going to have to get my January newsletter, but its implications, of course, will impact upon everyone in the listening audience, the Sybil Edmonds story, because, of course, she was threatened and told that she would not be allowed to let anybody know the rest of the story. And she was, a gag order was placed on her, and this is very, very seldom done, but the Justice Department told her she'd go to prison if she ever revealed what she knew, and she took her to the appeals court and the United States Supreme Court eventually to try to get permission to tell the story, what she knew. And she was quiet then until she went, well, just this month, in January, she went to the Sunday Times over in London, and she told the whole story. And, of course, it was published by the Sunday Times. It's known throughout the world. It's up on the Internet and totally blacked out in America because the implications of her story are so frightening, so overwhelming, so all-encompassing that Well, they can't let the American people know the truth. And the implications, of course, as we point out in our January letter, are truly frightening. Now, if you subscribe to a letter, well, you'll get that. Otherwise, you can request a copy, and we'll get it for you later. But it'll be probably a month before it's out, but it's an amazing, amazing story. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've got Greg calling from Flint, Michigan. Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I'm honored to meet you.
Well, I'm glad to have you. I appreciate you calling in, and I'll just once again mention our telephone number. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. How's the weather back there in Flint?
Very cold.
I bet it is. It's even cold here in California. So if it's cold here, it must be really cold back in Flint.
Yeah, we've got a couple inches of snow today, but I like the winter, so that's all right.
Okay, fine. Well, do you have a question or comment?
Yes. I just have a quick question. Could you explain very briefly where you think the creation of the Federal Department of Education fits into the scheme of things of the New World Order crowd?
Well, of course, they want the Federal Department of Education because they want to be able to control the minds of our children. And certainly, if you have all these little independent school departments out across the country, you would not be able to have a federal control. And this really, of course, they want to indoctrinate our children. Well, first of all, in this idea that we're all world citizens, that they want to indoctrinate them in the threat of environmental catastrophe, and they want to destroy their love for God and family and country. And actually, if you haven't read Charlotte Isabey's book, and she was a senior analyst there in the Department of Education, her book is entitled The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. We carry a book. You can go to our website, deliberatedumbingdown.com, and I think you can pull it down off the internet. But we do carry the book, and we recommend people get it and read it, because she points out that the Department of Education under Ronald Reagan, she was there, of course, during the early 80s, and Ronald Reagan had promised to do away with the Department of Education, but he didn't do it. Of course, he made lots of promises that he never even tried to keep, but she found out that the Department of Education, our Department of Education, had signed secret agreements with the Soviets, and they were going to use the same techniques in both the Soviet Union and here to indoctrinate the children so that they would go along with this idea eventually of creating this one world government, and of course, by destroying their faith in God, why, of course, they would actually, of course, create this new world religion. Although that was not specifically stipulated, what was stipulated is they were going to... The Department of Education in this country was going to cooperate with the communists in Moscow as far as the indoctrination of the youth of both those nations. And of course, these same things are being done throughout the world as we're destroying any sense of patriotism that our children can have. And we're going to be back here in just a moment. And you hang on, Greg. We'll be right with you here as we bring our other stations all back on board here.
All right. Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we have Greg from Flint, Michigan on the line. He was asking about the Department of Education, and I simply was telling him about, of course, how the Department of Education is certainly unconstitutional. But it was formed in violation of our Constitution because the elitists, the globalists, CFR globalists who run our country really wanted to control the education of our children, destroy their belief in God and family and country, and of course program to accept socialism and one world government. And they're doing a pretty good job. Most of our kids really, of course, have no idea that we are a republic, not a democracy. They don't even know the difference between a republic and a democracy. They don't understand anything about our Constitution, the fact that our founding fathers feared government, and that is why they actually wrote the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, to limit the power of the government so men could be free. And instead of that, of course, most of our young people believe that government can provide for us from the cradle to the grave, and we have to look to government to take care of people's health, and we have to have the federal government do everything for us, and that's the only way we're going to have freedom is to have the government provide for us. And nobody ever tells the young people that it is down throughout history it has been government that has deprived people of their freedom. And unfortunately, it will be no different here in America. Now, is there anything else, Greg?
I imagine the homosexual crowd's really heavy into that, too, that global education and such.
Well, we have to understand that a lot of homosexuals, they don't necessarily agree with what their leaders are doing, but you have your self-appointed leaders who are usually well-financed by the great tax-exempt foundations and many times are getting grants from government under the name of trying to fight the AIDS epidemic, which they're not doing. They blocked any intelligent efforts to control the AIDS epidemic, but the leadership has an agenda, and of course that is to really demoralize our country and lead us into paths of hedonism. And so the average homosexual is being used. They're as much a victim as this as you and I are, in fact, because of the policies of the AIDS activists. Why almost over half a million people are dead in the United States, and certainly almost a quarter of a million homosexuals are dead of that over half a million. And it is all because of the AIDS activists blocking an effective public health policy towards the stopping the epidemic. So as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I would not blame the homosexuals. I would blame their leaders who frighten the homosexuals, who use them, to manipulate them. And unfortunately, there's a spiritual component behind the homosexual movement as well. And
right. They're
sort of in revolt against God.
Right. Okay, I guess that'll do it. And thank you for taking my call.
All right, fine. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we'll be back here in just a moment. But give us a call if you have a question or comment, because this is Open Line Wednesday. But I started out telling you the amazing story of Sybil Edmonds, who had done everything she could to possibly get permission to tell the American people what she had discovered when she was working as a translator for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And, of course, after the gag order was placed on her by the U.S. Justice Department, and she was threatened with imprisonment if she ever dared tell what was going on, she appealed the case to the district court in Washington, D.C., and of course, the Justice Department said that the information she had threatened the national security of our nation. She went to the appeals court in Washington, D.C., and they agreed with the district court. She appealed to the United States Supreme Court for permission to tell her story and have her case heard in court. And the United States Supreme Court refused to hear the case. And you have to ask yourself, what does Sybil Edmonds know that is so important that they cannot let the American people know, and that they would go to all this trouble to try to block her? She went to members of Congress, to Senator Leahy and to Grassley, and I've forgotten who the other one of the congressmen, and they agreed with her that her story was important, but of course they would not be at liberty to release it, although they did support her in the things she did. She went up the ranks through the FBI to Robert Mueller, who was head of the FBI at that time. She did everything imaginable to try to get her story out, and Sydney, she could not get it out through regular channels, and anybody who alluded it to it was more or less threatened. And then, of course, the most significant thing was that finally, in January of this year, Sybil Edmonds went to the Sunday Times, which is a Sunday edition of the London Times, and she actually told the story, risking imprisonment because she felt her story was so important. And of course, the media here in the United States has refused to pick it up. All of the media in the United States has refused to pick it up. I haven't read any reference to it in any one of the half dozen newspapers that I've read on a daily basis. So there's something about her story that is very, very special. Now, if you're out there in the listening audience, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. So, Sybil Edmonds has risked being arrested and sent to prison, and she's told her story. And what is the essence of her story? Well, the essence of her story is that there was a spy ring, a Turkish spy ring, and it was working with the Israelis and Israeli spy ring that was working at the highest levels of our government, had people planted in both the U.S. State Department and in the military, in the Pentagon. And they were taking military secrets and military supplies of a nuclear nature, and they were shipping them primarily to Pakistan, although they were shipping them to other countries, but primarily to Pakistan. So basically, of course, we had given Pakistan the ability to build nuclear weapons. Now, remember, what the material she had goes back to 2001. And, of course, what is really so significant is the FBI knew all about this. The FBI was investigating. They knew all about this spy ring that was working at the highest levels of our government and involved people at the highest levels in the State Department. She's named one of the people who was working in the State Department. And although I'm not at liberty to give his name, why, it is known to the people of the Sunday Times, and they've checked with him. Of course, he denies it. He's left government, but the implications of the fact that the American government had intentionally allowed this spy ring to operate and transfer the nuclear technology and nuclear supplies to Pakistan so they could build nuclear weapons flies in the face of what they're trying to convince the average American, and that is that our government is doing everything they can to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. And they don't want to spread nuclear weapons. We're talking about going to war with Iran because they might get nuclear weapons. And yet it was our government knowingly, intentionally allowed the spy ring to ship these supplies and nuclear material to Pakistan so they could build a bomb that was sent to Dr. Khan, who is the Pakistani nuclear scientist. And then, of course, he was the one who gave the information to Iran and to Libya and to North Korea. Well, of course, this isn't a frightening thing, because what it really means is that our government wanted Pakistan to have the nuclear bomb, and you have to ask yourself why. And, of course, it is my contention that, as with the Second World War and the Vietnam War and the Korean War and the current war we're involved in, we were arming our enemies so we could have a great war. It was American corporations were building weapons for Adolf Hitler both before and during the Second World War. And if you haven't read the book Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, or my interview with Professor Sutton, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, that's available on DVD. If you haven't, of course, read my material on the Communist Capitalist Alliance, it's a pamphlet we have based upon extensive studying, and of course we finance communism since its inception because we need an enemy. And then, of course, during the Vietnam War, why the United States and American corporations were funding Russia, that was funding the North Vietnamese, that was funding the Viet Cong, were killing our boys in the rice paddies of Vietnam. And then, of course, today we're funding the Pakistanis, or funding the Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, that's funding the Taliban, that are killing our boys in the poppy fields of Afghanistan. But even more frightening is the implication we've actually given Pakistan the nuclear weapons, and I believe this is in preparation for the coming war with the Muslim world. Hope and pray that I'm wrong. Well, we've got Dave calling from Peoria, Illinois. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we'd love to hear from you. Okay, Dave, how are you doing?
Good evening, Dr. Stan.
Well, good to hear from you.
I want to make a comment on this economy, the insane stock Wall Street. The Federal Reserve is doing exactly the wrong thing, in my opinion. They should be raising interest rates to cut off all the borrowing and insane spending. But by lowering interest rates, they're going to keep encouraging debt. It just can make the situation worse and worse, guaranteed. I think we're going to have hyperinflation. And I don't think American people have a clue it's coming. These moves they have to know what they're doing. They have to know what they're doing. They got to know that this is just going to cause just the worst of all worlds. Do you agree?
I agree with you totally. In fact, the thing is that they don't want the American people to know. Now, of course, the idea of lowering the interest rates and making credit more readily available is supposed to stimulate the economy and create liquidity for the banks. The problem is not problem of liquidity. It's a matter of solvency. These banks, of course, have got so many bad loans that they don't have enough capital, a base. In fact, they're having, of course, to destroy the entire financial base of our major banks, and that's why they're selling them off to Abu Dhabi and Singapore and certainly wealthy people throughout the world. Our financial institutions are having to sell themselves because they're insolvent, and that's what they're not saying. And you hang on there, Dave. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Okay, Dave, but I certainly agree with your basic premise. I think it's really very, very accurate. So the thing is, the major threat to America is not a recession. The major threat to America is the destruction of the value of our currency. And this is exactly what they're doing, is they're basically inflating the money supply. There's no way why you can increase credit, and that's just as good as money. And, of course, it'll be spent into the economy. And there's no way you can do what they're doing without increasing the M3, which they no longer publish because they don't want us to know what they're doing. And the implications is that they are going, of course, to go right ahead and simply create runaway inflation. Now, how bad it'll get, I really don't know. I hope that somebody of sanity will rein this in before we get to the point of the Weimar Republic or what's going on over in Zimbabwe today with the man the United States put into power. His name is Mugabe. But he was installed by the United States State Department after Henry Kissinger promised the people of Rhodesia, who did not want Mugabe, and he was not legitimately elected, but they promised them that they would come to Rhodesia's aid if they ever got into trouble. Well, today they have 15,000% inflation in Rhodesia, or Zimbabwe as they call it, and you can see what a great job we're doing to help the people there who are starving to death as a direct result of American foreign policy. So let's hope it doesn't ever get that bad here.
Well, Doc Stan, what I see happening, I see these idiots on TV, these so-called experts saying how the Fed's got to lead the world, it's got to lead the world economy, but I wonder how many Americans, I wonder if very many Americans get it, what we're headed towards. I mean, this is a gift to the bankers, it's a gift to the institutions, but it's a total, you know, screw job to the average American who isn't in the stock market. So, you know, the whole thing is infuriating to watch these crooks doing this stuff, because what's going to do to the average American? It's going to impoverish them.
Well, of course, I really believe that is part of the program. I think it was laid out in the Earth Charter, where they talked about equitable distribution of wealth within nations and between nations. Now, how could you get equitable distribution of wealth between nations when America's the richest nation in the world? And the only way to do that would be to impoverish our people, or, as I like to say, to raise the living standards of the average American to that of the Mexican peasant. And what they are going to do is wipe out the middle class. They know exactly what they're doing. There is a plan. And I tell people, go ahead and read the Earth Charter. Remember that this is written by some of the wealthiest people in our country. It was presented to the United Nations. Fortunately, it was not accepted, but it's kept in the Ark of Hope. It is considered to be the new Ten Commandments for the world. And, of course, it is simply a Luciferian counterpart of the Ten Commandments, which is kept in the Ark of the Covenant. So the plan is there for anybody to read. It's in the Earth Charter, which talks about how they are going, of course, to impoverish our people. Well, you're absolutely right, Dave. And our job is to try to get the American people to listen, and they don't want to hear what we're telling them today. But down the line, as they see the value of their pension fund and their insurance policies and their life savings being destroyed, they're going to be looking for answers, and we've got to be there to give it to them.
Well, Doc, one will come here, Doc Stan. You know, in my opinion, without manufacturing, you can't be a superpower. It's impossible.
You're absolutely right.
And so, you know, the factories are gone, they're not coming back. And so, as like Robert Chapman says, we're doomed. Unless someone like Ron Paul gets in power, we're doomed.
Well, our job is, of course, to do everything we can, because Bob Chapman wants to reimpose tariffs, which I believe is the only way that we're going to preserve our economy. Hang on there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've got Dave calling from Peoria, Illinois. Our telephone number, we're open line Wednesday, is telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We've got Dave calling from Peoria, Illinois, and he feels that what the Federal Reserve System is doing is absolutely wrong. The idea of lowering the interest rates and making credit readily available and flooding the economy with credit, you know, is going to increase liquidity, and that's supposed to, by Keynesian concepts, bring prosperity as you flood the nation with money or the equivalent of it in the way of credit. But of course, as Dave points out, this is not what you want to be doing at this time. What you want to be doing is raising interest rates and trying to prevent runaway inflation, because anybody who goes to the grocery store or goes to the local gas station knows we have inflation, despite what the government is telling us. Our inflation is rampant. It's probably running 10 or 11% at the present time, and of course, as a result of what's going on now, it'll probably be up to 15 to 18% by the end of this year. But they can't let the American people know that, or that they have a planned program to destroy the value of their currency. And of course, we quoted, I believe last week, from Alan Greenspan's book, The Age of Turbulence, where he quotes Lenin as saying the best way to destroy a nation is to debauch its currency, and not one person in a million will recognize what you're doing. Well, Dr. One Sam, person in a million will recognize what you're doing.
Well, Dr. Sam, you think about this. I was around the 1920s, but my parents were, and I understand that if you lived, let's say, 1925, something that would cost you a nickel would cost you a dollar today. That's unbelievable. And that's when I was a kid, Dr. Sam, back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, a new car may cost $3,000 or $4,000. Now that car costs $18,000 to $25,000.
Right.
And that tells it all right there.
Well, of course, I can remember the home that I was raised in. My folks bought it for $3,000 during the Depression. I suspect it would go for $100,000 today up in Oakland. I know the house I bought in Santa Cruz for $42,000. The last time it was listed for $2 million. Unfortunately, I don't still have it. It was a wonderful, wonderful home. But this simply shows the inflation. But I think that we're going to see a real crash as far as the housing market is concerned. Probably houses will lose at least 50% of their value, if not a great deal more. And of course, the trouble is an awful lot of people are going to have houses that they're paying monthly payments on that are worth far less than the appraised value that they're paying. And so a lot of people are just going to walk away from those houses, because if they had it all paid off, it still wouldn't be worth, anywhere near what it was before. And this is the fear, I'm sure, that many, many people, many, many of the people who really understand what's going on, recognize that as the value of housing goes, and let's say you bought a house for $300,000 and it is now worth $150,000, and you're still making payments as if it was worth $300,000, you're going to walk away from that house and try to get something with lower payments on it. And of course, the bank's stuck with it, and they have to dump it on the market, and that drives the prices down all the more. You see,
one more thing. You know, when I was a kid, okay, in most homes, a mother could stay home, be a mother, not work.
Right.
Today, women have to work.
Right.
That's because the dollar has been devalued intentionally by the criminals of the Federal Reserve System.
Well, actually, some women have two jobs. In fact, we have one of our repairmen who works two jobs, and his wife works two jobs. So, I mean, certainly it's unfortunate, but this is what happens when you get into a country with an unstable financial system, and that's exactly what's happened. And people don't understand the implications of what's happened into the foundation of our monetary system, and that this did not happen by accident. They knew exactly what was going on, and certainly if you haven't read the book Creature from Jekyll Island, we recommend it, or we're going to have another great new little book called The Secret Side of History, which is a very brief form of the Creature, because The Creature is quite a large book. But basically, this has happened time and time and time again throughout history. Ancient Greece, ancient Rome, in Venice, in Florence, and certainly then, of course, in France during the early part of the 1700s, in America during the Civil War, pardon me, during the Revolutionary War and then in France in 1789. There's nothing new under the sun, Dave. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American people to know. Until it's too late, and I really fear that most people are going to get wiped out financially. I'm just hoping our listeners will prepare themselves, get out of the stock market, certainly will prepare themselves in a defensive position.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Stan.
Okay, bye-bye, and God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we'd love to hear from you. And we've got Charles calling on the line. And Charles is calling from Harlem, New York. Hi, Charles. How are you doing?
How are you, Dr. Stan?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Do you listen to us on the shortwave or listen to us on the Internet?
Actually, I was in Albany, New York, so I'm listening to you on WJIP.
Okay, fine. That's a big Utica station up there, isn't it?
That's correct.
Okay, fine. Go ahead. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, didn't mean to plug Robert Chapman's newsletter, but he included a section from Harry Schultz, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Right, sure. And Harry's been around for a long time. He must be in his 80s now.
Right, and the little piece that he included basically said, the gist of it was, Harry feels within about 12 months, we'll be looking at depression, which was rather startling, and I guess it was something that Bob Chapman felt he needed to put in the forecast, because he is a seasoned veteran who's seen all these signs and understands what he's looking at, saying, we're looking at possibly a depression in 12 months, which...
Well, now, Chris, was this in the issue that came out today?
No, I'm sorry, this was last Wednesday.
Okay, last Wednesday, okay, fine.
And I actually haven't had the time to get to this Wednesday, unfortunately.
All right, well, one just came today. We did get one over the weekend. Well, certainly, you can put a plug for Bob Chapman's newsletter. We don't get anything, for plugging it, but we believe Chapman has a lot of well worthwhile things to say, and this is why we have him on our program every Wednesday, every Monday at our 3 o'clock Genesis program, 3 o'clock Pacific time, and then, of course, we have him on twice a month, and we'll have him on again early in February, because these are certainly exciting financial times. And of course, Harry Schultz, I've followed Harry for probably 40 years, and I certainly have the greatest respect for his opinion. And if he says we're going to be in depression in what, about a year?
Yeah, he figures about 12 months we'll be heading that way, which I was shocked, like, wow, that quick.
Well I really think that it's coming. I think it's only a matter of time. I think that probably, what is going to happen to America will overshadow what happened back in the 1930s as far as the Depression is concerned, and certainly we don't have an industrial base. Back then we had an industrial base, we had a sound currency, and hang on, we'll be right back in just a moment here.
Great.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And certainly we have with us Charles, who's calling from Harlem. Not from Harlem. He's up in Attica, New York. So I don't know how we got Harlem there. But anyway.
That's where I'm originally from. I'm just actually driving from Albany back to Harlem, New York.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, of course. And my producer was just saying that James Dines, who I also have a great deal of respect for, there have maybe half a dozen people that I write on finances I respect, and certainly one of them is Harry Schultz, and one of them is James Dines, and certainly Martin Weiss, I believe, is very, very astute in what he's saying, but certainly... James Dines is talking about a depression as well, and we take his newsletter, and I'm sure that he wouldn't mind my sharing with you what he said in his annual wrap-up. We just received it, at least my friend did. And for some reason, I didn't get it. It's 50 pages. But Dinesby believes that we're on the verge of a depression as well, and certainly so does Bob Chapman. So our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, Chris, what happens is we saw what had happened over in Japan in 1990 after they had this exuberant stock market, and everybody was saying, well, the stock market's 40,000, but it's going to 100,000. And of course, well, it didn't quite get there. It dropped to about 20,000, or probably a lot less than that, and many of the property values dropped 90%. In fact, at one time, the value of the Imperial Palace in Tokyo, the land under the Imperial Palace, was worth as much as all of the land in the state of California. I mean, it was just unbelievable, you know, the inflation that they had. And then it was then that the Japanese were over here buying the Rockefeller Center and Pebble Beach Golf Course. But, of course, when things turned and suddenly, you know, they had eight of the largest banks, the 10 largest banks in the world were Japanese. Well, in a few short months, those became literally penny stocks, and many of them have never recovered. So this sort of thing can happen to any country that gets onto a fiat money system and acts irresponsibly. And, you know, there are people all throughout the world, Charles, who hate America because of our policies of aggression, and because our CIA is over there in their country rigging their elections and killing the people that, you know, don't go along with our agenda, our globalist agenda. Most Americans really don't understand how these things work, but for people out there who want to understand how the world really runs, the book, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, we still have a few copies, although it's going out of print. We do have a four-tape set of my interviews with John Perkins, who wrote the book, Economic Hitman, and he simply tells, he worked with this. He was working for under the auspices of the National Security Agency, the NSA, and talked about how, of course, they would go into countries, and, you know, if the leaders there would not go along or they couldn't be gotten out of office, they'd simply have them killed. They'd send in their, what he called them, the jackals, and their job was to kill the world leaders, but he can't keep doing that year after year. So that we can live well and other people can live in poverty without developing a tremendous amount of animosity. And there are countries all throughout the world who want to see our country destroyed. Now, I don't want to see our country destroyed.
No.
But I do want to replace the wicked and evil men who control the CIA. And remember, the head of the CIA always comes from the Council on Foreign Relations. And the people who, of course, control the NSA and its policies of simply tapping telephones of everyone anywhere in the world, and this is really what we do. That's Project Echelon, and all this talk about so concerning about our, that they're tapping the lines of some terrorists without a warrant. This is all simply foolishness. We've been tapping everybody's telephone lines and reading their emails and faxes. If you doubt that, if you have access to a computer, go up and read about Project Echelon. We have a book on it. It's called NSA Big Brother. Big Brother is watching you, and it's an excellent book. We've been around for 10 years, but Echelon's been around for 30 or 40 years. And we listen to everybody's conversations. That's how many times our corporations get the advantage on foreign corporations, because we know what their bids are going to be. We listen to their conversations, and then they tell our people so they can underbid them. And of course, most people have never heard of Project Echelon, but it's there. It's real. If anybody wants information, they can call us at 1-888-1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We'll get you information and documentation on that, or let me suggest the book, Big Brother is Watching You, I believe is the title. But anyway, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But I appreciate you reminding me of that. I really didn't, I read Bob Chapman very, very faithfully, but I must have missed that reference from Harry Schultz. But I agree totally. And I think we're moving into very, very difficult financial times, and people have to get their monetary system in order and get out of the stock market and preserve as much capital as they can and put it into something that will not be eroded as the dollar continues to drop. Anything else you'd like to say, Charlie?
Yes, Dr. Stan, I wanted to ask you to speak to, well, here's the question. The 503 tax-exempt program for faith-based initiatives.
501c3 is the 501c3. And, of course, this gives you a tax-exempt status. You become a government corporation, whether you're a church or an organization, and of course it has certain advantages because then donations become tax exempt, but you come under their control and you're limited in what you can say and do.
Now my question there is, and I'm speaking about specifically pastors. Now my question is, obviously I understand the benefits that they see, or pastor sees, or an organization may see for being under that umbrella, but at the same time, they must, if a small hamster mind like me understands that I would have to succumb to whatever their rules are, they must understand it as well, and we have to answer to the Lord, period. And if some those of us that are charged with spreading the gospel and teaching and taking care of the flock have to do so, then we can't afford to have restrictions that would kind of keep us from doing what the Lord has asked us to do. My question, in short, is, I guess I'll just say it as blunt as I can. What's going through the pastor's mind? Does he not know? Is everyone ignorant? I mean, what's happening?
Well, I think that they really don't know. They don't understand the implications. And, of course, this is what everybody else is doing. And after all, that way you can, you know, your parishioners can deduct the donations to the church. You get in more money, and that's in the back of their mind, although I don't think that's the primary motivation. But nobody's ever explained to them the implications. The fact that they are limited in what they can do, and certainly they cannot endorse a political candidate any more than anybody who's in a 501c3 organization. So you cannot endorse a political candidate, and of course, if you were to say something bad about a political candidate when the election was going on, why, they would come and threaten you. And this happened to our friend Tex Mars. Tex Mars, of course, at the time when Bill Clinton was being, it wasn't even an election cycle. In other words, the election was not coming up. But Bill Clinton was, had been indicted, for obstruction of justice. And Tex Mars went on to his radio program and said that the president was a crook. He'd been indicted. And the IRS was right there, to see him.
Wow.
And told him that they were going to pull his 501c3 status because he said the president was a crook. And Tex said, look, he's been indicted by the Congress of the United States for obstruction of justice and suborning, encouraging perjury. And the fellow said, that doesn't matter, you can't say it, we're going to pull your 501c3 status. And that's exactly what they did. So we had a 501c3 and we gave it up here at Radio Liberty. And I wanted to let our listeners know we're not 501c3. We do what we do, and we want to be able to say the truth. So if people don't like what we say, well, that's up to them. But we're going to tell the truth, and we're not going to be limited by what the government tells us we can or cannot do.
Great job by you. Thank you, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure. And my prayers for you, your ministry, and as well as the listeners, because everyone's being edified by what you bring to the table. And I thank the Lord for you, as well as your listeners. A lot of your listeners are very interesting as well as your guests. So thank you again. God bless.
God bless, and thank you so very much for calling. That was Charles calling from, Charles was listening to the station up there, I guess, in Attica, New York. We've got Jack calling from Michigan. Hi, Jack. How are you doing?
Hi. Very well, thank you. It is cold here in Flint, Michigan.
I bet it is. Okay.
Yeah.
How cold is it?
18 above.
18 above. Well, that's pretty cold as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
We complain when we get to about 34 degrees Fahrenheit. And, of course, that's not cold at all by your standards. So go ahead.
Well, Dr. Stan, in view of the fact that the government has lied to us over and over, history repeats itself, I resolve myself, and I've mentioned this before, I tell everyone when I can on a daily basis to tune into the program, go to your website and read your newsletters and purchase whatever they can afford to purchase. Because I think singularly your program and your website, I'm going to organize. I know there was a guy, Greg from Flint, who called. If he's still listening, I can always leave my phone number with your producer, and if he wants to contact me, I'm organizing a countywide, I don't know what else to call it, think tank, you know, to counter the think tanks over in the District of Corruption, Washington, D.C., as Bo Greitz refer to them. And then I want them to go to BobPlimpton.com, because at BobPlimpton.com they can read his stellar treatise on this whole range of subject matter regarding government law, the monetary system, etc. Because on his homepage, the librarian tells me, I don't have a computer, but she says there's a blue bar at BobPlimpton.com on the homepage. You click on that, and then you can read the book called You Were Born Free, Now You Can Live Free. And I just want to quote one thing here. He quotes Alan Keyes, since we're in the tax season. He says, like it or not, this is Alan Keyes, you are a slave. You admit you are a slave every April 15th. That's when you sign forms that, quote, voluntarily lay bare to the government the most private details of your life. Few people realize the income tax is a slave tax. It can never be compatible with the life of a free people. And then a couple paragraphs down says, every cent of money you send the IRS is used to make payment of principal interest to the privately owned Federal Reserve Bank against the artificially created bankruptcy of the municipal corporate United States. And then he goes on to cite, in 1933, the executive order that FDR issued that was, you know, that collected, forced, coerced the return or the forfeiture, the surrender of people's gold stores, and then he goes on to, he quotes a Department of Justice lawyer through Freedom of Information, and this is in around 97, and the DOJ lawyer said, it's a popular myth that executive orders apply to private people. They apply only to those in government.
Well, of course, that is the way it should be. Unfortunately, Jack, very little is as it really should be, and you're absolutely right. The executive orders were simply a housekeeping for the executive branch of government. However, in practice, they've been extended to the individual. And, of course, you can say, well, you don't have the right to do that, as they're taking you away to prison in handcuffs. So, unfortunately, we have people within the government who've taken over our government, who don't believe in our Constitution, who do not believe in the rule of law. They've created their own justices. They put them on the Supreme Court.
Right.
And what most people do not recognize is there are powerful spiritual forces behind what's going on today that really want a dictatorship in America. I love this country, but we've turned our back on our heritage. I mean, we can talk all we want to about the Constitution, but until the American people are willing to take a stand and insist on restoring the Constitution and refuse to vote for any politician who will not uphold the Constitution, we will continue down the road towards slavery. And you're absolutely right, but it doesn't matter. They use these executive orders to control the individuals, even though it is lawless, but we have people in government who do not believe in law. They believe in power, and this is the problem we face today, as you well know.
Yeah, in fact, I know here is this James Madison, president. History records the money changers have used every form of abuse, intrigue, deceit, and violent means possible to maintain their control over government by controlling money and its issuance.
And, of course, this is true, but this has been true, you know, for many, many thousands of years.
Yeah,
and you can trace money back to certainly the time, though, perhaps 600 or 700 B.C., when, of course, we first got started, with minting of coins. But you go back and you read the Bible, you know, certainly they talk about gold and silver being used as a mechanism of exchange in the opening books of Genesis. Certainly Abraham, who lived 2,000 years B.C., actually bought the place there in Hebron where they buried his wife. They actually bought the cave for 20 pounds of silver, and that's biblical. So certainly they've been using gold and silver as a means of exchange going back thousands of years. It's only been recently, of course, that they've substituted worthless paper. They can print as much as they want to, so that they can actually enrich the money changers and impoverish the people.
Yep.
There's no instance in all history where a nation has gone on to a fiat money system where that nation has survived. And tragically, every nation in the world today is on a fiat money system. That you may be interested to know that the Swiss, apparently, are refusing to take any more depositors from the United States. They say they don't want their money.
Wow.
They do not want Americans go over and investing in Switzerland. They're trying to isolate themselves so they can survive. Maybe we ought to isolate ourselves so we can survive.
Absolutely. There you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, look, Jack, it's good to hear from you, and we'll talk to you later. God bless, too. Bye-bye. All right, well, this is Dr. Stan. It's Open Lines, and we have one more caller, and then we'll be wrapping up the program. So remember, you're always welcome to call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, right here at Radio Liberty on Open Lines Wednesday. And we have Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi, Stan. Regarding Jack's call and executive orders, I just wanted to tell people there's a website you can go to that I find the most useful out of all of them, at least so far. It's called the American Presidency Project. If you just go on Google and type in American Presidency Project, you'll come to the University of California at Santa Barbara website where they have thousands of presidential documents going all the way back, and they've got 3,800 executive orders. Now that's only about a quarter of all the orders that have been written, but I think what they've done is picked out the most important ones. And you can go through there and see how presidential executive orders are being used, really, to as a dictatorship. And my favorite one to talk about is Executive Order 12803. If you want to see something that goes far, far beyond the executive branch into the private lives of citizens, it puts everything for sale, every government asset up for sale, all the way down to local school boards and tribal reservations, Indian tribal reservations. That's pretty ridiculous, but it's never been challenged by Congress. I know time's limited, but that's just, I hope people will go on there and start rooting around and seeing what sorts of outrageous things you can come up with.
All right, God bless, and thanks so much, Mike. And let's go to Todd, who's calling from upstate New York. Hi, Todd, quick question.
Yeah, quick question. I just wondered if you have any feedback personally from you, because I remember the last Republican on TV when they had the debate. Ron Paul was asked a question, I don't have the quote, but about the 9/11 truth movement, and he said he basically disavowed himself from that movement. I don't know, because to me that's like kind of an unusual statement, because he said he doesn't go along with their agenda or whatever now.
Well, I think you have to understand that he's under the gun, because, of course, if he was to say there was a conspiracy, they would come after him. But I will tell you that Joel Skousen talked to his campaign manager, who assured him that if Ron Paul was the president, he would welcome an independent investigation. In fact, he would launch an independent investigation.
He's on the smart thing.
Sometimes you can't say everything you believe, especially when you've got the entire media against you, and you're the only person who's talking about the Constitution. So I don't think he said he disavowed it, but he didn't necessarily agree with it. So I think that it was probably a good answer. He knows, of course, he's a very smart man. He knows we haven't been told the truth.
Kind of like a nod, wink, wink.
That's right. God bless. Thanks so much, Todd.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sydney, I hope you've enjoyed our open lines. I always enjoy them anyway. And there's really so much to talk about. So remember, every Wednesday, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, but there's no time for further calls. This is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you're out there across America and you agree with me that we're really involved in a spiritual war being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield, why, of course, we do hope that many of you will join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And you do that by simply calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we do hope that you'll want to get some of our material, certainly my three pamphlet set on the occult hierarchy. We'll introduce you to the people who really run the world. I don't even know if I should call them people, because, of course, some of them certainly are human beings, but there are spiritual forces out there as well that influence people, and they openly talk about how they influence people. You'll be fascinated, because we give you the sources of reference from the writings of the people who have affiliated themselves with the Lucis Trust and other similar organizations. And I might point out that they are financed by some of the wealthiest people in the world. And we got this on their websites. Fortunately, we were able to pull down the documentation. They pulled it off. The last thing they want is for the people to understand that who really is financing and who is working within these Luciferian organizations. But you can go to LuciusTrust.org. LuciusTrust.org. It used to be Lucifer Publishing House. Lucifer Publishing House. And what you must understand is this is the Gnostic belief that there are two gods. One is the God you and I worship, and that's an inferior God. The real God is Lucifer, who gives you real freedom. Because, of course, you know, the God we worship has all sorts of thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness. But, of course, the whole idea of the Luciferians is you have total freedom. And that, of course, is what they want. And that's why we're in the trouble we are today, and why we're fighting throughout the world, because Lucifer wants to rule the world, and that's why the major goal of the people on the other side is the one world government, the one world religion, the one world leader. Now, you need to get our material, certainly my talk on the forbidden truth, my talk on Brotherhood of Darkness, or the book by that title, certainly the DVD, The Atlantis Connection, was available from Radio Liberty. It was talk given by Chris Pinto, who put together those two great DVDs, really award-winning, professionally done, The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning and Riddles in Stone, The Secret History of the Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And certainly, if you've never heard the videos or DVDs, they sold their souls for rock and roll. You should get the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version, and you'll never look at the world or music in the same way. But understand, it's not just in music where the people have sold their souls. It is in politics and in banking. And of course, you'll read my January newsletter. We will simply quote from them telling how they have people working in finance. So much of what's taking place financially is under the control of these spiritual forces as well. And if you really look around as to why, of course, the leaders of our country and the leaders of communism has always worked together. And if you haven't read my pamphlet, The Communist Capitalist Alliance, you need to get it. That's The Communist Capitalist Alliance. And you find out how we finance communism since its inception, and we're still financing it today. Why would we do that? Why? Because the leaders of the globalist CFR, globalists who control our nation, and the communists have many things in common. They both believe in elites should rule the masses. They believe, of course, that they want a one-world government and a one-world religion and a one-world leader. And, of course, they are both energized by the same spiritual forces. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, well, of course, our guest today for this hour is going to be Barry Shamish. And Barry is a Jewish patriot. He's an Israeli citizen who's, of course, here in the United States, married to an American citizen who actually was forced to leave Israel because of threats on his life, and his life was endangered because he's been writing for many years about the assassination of Rabin, the premier over there of Israel. And, of course, Rabin was assassinated by his own government, by this the counterpart of the American FBI, and, of course, they have the lone patsy who supposedly had shot Rabin from the back, but the bullet wounds came from the front, and supposedly they transected his spinal column, but he was able to walk and get into the car, and Barry has a movie of that, or I guess a DVD of that, fascinating. But of course he's written books, and he's been able to convince almost half of the religious Jews in Israel that Rabin was actually killed, not by a lone assassin, but part of a government cover-up, and he was killed under the auspices of high people in the government, just as here in the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy was killed as part of a conspiracy and covered up by the Warren Commission because it involved the CIA and the mafia hitmen that they employed and the special forces teams that were there, of course, supervising the assassination. But we can't tell the American people any more than they could allow Barry to continue telling the Israeli people about the assassination of their leader. And you have to understand that both Israel and the United States are controlled by the same forces. And, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR Global, is here, has a powerful grip on Olmert, who's the current premier or prime minister, I guess, of Israel. Anyway, Barry Shamish, without further ado, why don't you pick up the story?
Well, there's a lot of stories. I wrote a piece this week, which I have a style to criticize, and the Jewish leaders, a whole bunch of them, signed a document and they put ads in papers backing Obama, Barack. They signed this thing that Jews should not judge him. We live in a democracy, and he's not a Muslim. And it was just the most pandering, awful advertisement for the Jews. And they did the same thing during the 40s.
But I think the important thing for our listeners to know is that apparently Obama was affiliated with a church where the minister was a good, close personal friend of Farrakhan. Well, Farrakhan is violently anti-Semitic and equated, it certainly supports the Palestinians and the radical jihadists. And so the fact that Obama was associated with this man, had worked for him, had worked in his projects, and this has been fairly well covered up. And so because, of course, people were saying that Obama had to be anti-Semitic because, of course, he was backing Louis Farrakhan, and that's the reason that the Jews actually put this out, at least not the Jews, but these leaders of these so-called Jewish groups, which I don't think represent Jewry at all.
Well, of course, they're not elected. And they, in some cases, they actually set up the Jewish organizations just to have something to spend it on, their money. And they give each other awards and banquets. And it's I'll talk about that someday. When I was a PR writer in Jerusalem for the UJA and Israel Bonds, they would actually give trophies to each other.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment, Barry. Okay, you go right ahead.
If you can imagine that, to raise money, they would have a dinner on behalf of someone who, I guess, helped in some way. Who knows why? I guess everybody gets a dinner, and they would just have a pledge, you know, just gather pledges for whatever charity he enjoyed, and that's how they made money, by giving each other trophies. And you would always hire someone who was supposedly famous, usually an Israeli cabinet minister. If you were really good, you would, like, get Teddy Kollegah or somebody be the guest speaker. At the end of the evening, you gave the guy a crummy little trophy. You go to a sports shop, you buy a trophy and put his name on it, and he would be in tears thinking that he had actually won something. And there's a culture out there that does this. And these people, this ad for Obama Baraka was of that culture. They had all given these people trophies, and by the way, I've gone into their homes and they show me their trophies. They're very proud of them. But of course, they're trophies for nothing. They didn't win anything. They didn't accomplish anything. And when these people put the ad up for Barack, I wrote, as I told you, by the way, this week, that I would write kind of a daring sarcasm. In the end, it was called Uncle Tom's Jew Boys.
And I've read it, and I'll have to admit, I thought it was very, very clever and very well done. I think only you could write that. I think anybody else would feel it was, you know, it was violently racist, but I thought that it was well done.
Well, anyone who thinks it's racist would be missing the whole point of it all.
I know. Go right ahead. No, I mean, I enjoyed it thoroughly.
I'm glad to hear that, and so did a lot of people. But I had people offended. A couple of people left my list. I guess they thought I was anti-black, you know, which is ridiculous. If anything, it was anti-Jew, you know. But whatever, I was neither, obviously. I was making a point that when the Jewish nation is in trouble, the last thing you do is pander for someone who doesn't like the Jewish nation. And I got a wonderful... Now, I'm going to tell you a couple of the results of this. Even though we will return to what we've spoken about...
Hold that thought there for just a moment.
Gotcha.
Shall we bring our other stations back on board here? All right, fine. Well, I guess this evening, of course, is Barry Samus, and he's talking about an essay he wrote this week, and he'd sent it to me on the internet. It was called, and I hope I have the right title. It was called "Uncle Tom's Jew Boys." Now, remember, Barry is Jewish, so he can he certainly is not criticizing the Jewish race, but he is criticizing these men in these American organizations who pretend to be Jewish, but of course are backing Obama, who is closely affiliated with Louis Farrakhan, who is of course closely affiliated with the Arab movement. And of course Farrakhan is a well-known anti-Semite, and of course anyway, go right ahead.
Well, I wrote it in the Negro dialect of 1850. Uncle Tom's Cabin dialect, except I had these Jews backing Obama. They're talking like an 1850s Uncle Tom Black. So I actually thought it was pretty clever, but I got a letter from a woman I knew in Israel. She lives in Beit Shemesh. Her name is Hadassah, and she's black. She's an American black, and I got along perfectly well with her. I always considered her a nice woman. And she wrote me a very supportive letter. And then she said something that surprised me. And she said, she knows all about Obama, and she added stuff to me. And she says, yeah, but, you know, Obama is Dick Cheney's cousin.
And that's really, she's really right. True. Supposedly about eighth removed.
That's right. But I wrote her back. And I sent it to you yesterday, by the way, the link to the interview with Cheney's wife. And they're proud of him. They think that listen, the Cheney family believes that Barack Obama is their cousin, genetically. I mean, we're not talking about we're all brothers on this planet, and this bothers me, number one, the odds of this person running for president while his cousin is the vice president sitting is, of course, in normal circumstances, impossible.
Well, of course, but how about one president, you know, and then, of course, his son is president 8 years later. I mean, and then, of course, we have a man who is the president, and now his wife is running for the presidency 8 years later. So, and so why should we be surprised that, you know, we should have cousins, distant cousins, running for the chief executive of the United States when we see this, this incest that's being played out in the presidential, by the presidents?
Well, normally you would just call these dynasties, but in the case of a black man running for president and a white man sitting as vice president, you would not expect them to be related. Did you know that there was a relationship before I sent you that yesterday?
Yes. I'd actually seen the interview with Mrs. Cheney, where she talked about the fact that Obama was a distant cousin.
I tell you, those days when you didn't admit it. I mean, my goodness, how that happened throughout history would probably be not worthy of admitting. Something Clinton would have talked about the back of the barn. No, that was Carter and the back of the barn. But nonetheless, that's what this lady wrote me from Jerusalem. And I got a couple more letters saying the same thing, that Obama's getting help and you don't know where it's coming from, and so on and so forth. That he's more of an insider than you even wrote. So I got that, which is, you know, a very good reaction. I didn't know about that. But there's one more thing I want to talk about before I go into what we've already spoken about, and that's the wall being torn down between Gaza and the Sinai Peninsula. That happened, I think, last night or the night before, where Fatah blew up the wall. It's along something called the Philadelphia Corridor, which separates Egypt from the Gaza Strip. And, well, what do you know? There's no separation anymore.
See, how come they can build a wall that, you know, between Gaza and Egypt, but we can't build a wall between the United States and Mexico? I think we built about 3 miles of it now in a couple of years.
Well, the moral of this story is don't put up walls.
Right.
There are 300,000 Gazans roaming around northern Sinai right now. Israel put up the wall, by the way, I suppose, to stop smuggling. This was in Gush Katif, Israeli territory, this wall. And, well, what do you know, Egypt, and I'm following the reports now, Egypt doesn't know what to do about it, and Egypt says there's nothing we can do about it. There are 300,000 of them there. If we send in soldiers and start shooting them and make them go back to Gaza, there'll be a massacre, and it won't play well in Peoria, I suppose. So Egypt is now stuck with an open border between it and Gaza, and I think it's just wonderful. I've been pushing the Sinai Peninsula as a perfect place for Palestine. I mean, it's empty. There was, when I pushed this idea, only 30,000 people living there, none of whom were Egyptian. They were all Bedouins. And you could make 36,000 square miles. And when Israel had the Sinai, it was flourishing. There were beautiful cities all through the Sinai, and why not just give it to the Palestinians and come up with a deal where a little more water comes in through the Nile, you build a canal, and you have a state. And you have a state where there aren't, well, You're not going to disturb anybody. And this wall coming down, I think it might be the beginning of a Palestinian state in the Sinai Peninsula. I think it's heading that way right now. The population of the Sinai has quadrupled, more than quadrupled.
Well, I think, of course, you're trying to come up with a solution. I think the powers that be don't want a solution. I think they want a problem. And if this was the logical solution, they would do everything they could to avoid it. Go right ahead.
Well, again, I thought it was always the logical conclusion. It's empty land. It was never Egyptian. It was the British gave it to the Turks in 1906 I've discussed this. The Turks gave the Germans Mount Zion to build a giant church. It's called the Dormition Abbey. This was in 1897. It was built in 1906. And, well, the Turks got very scared and decided to appease the British, and they gave the Sinai. It was never Egyptian. Later, when Egypt got independence, they just took the Turkish Sinai and added it to their territory, but the people who lived there are Bedouins. So I figured this is a great solution. There's an empty piece of land, and it's not a bad piece of land. There's potential there. Well, whatever I might have thought is actually happening right now. Gaza has overrun the northern Sinai, and it looks like nobody can get rid of them now. It looks like this is going to be the way it is.
But Barry, why are they going there? Is there water? Is there food? Are there supplies? My understanding is that they'd gone there because, of course, they didn't have any food or supplies in Gaza.
Well, that's what I was going to lead into, okay, of course, was the phony humanitarian crisis of a starving Gaza. This was 2 days after Israel embargoed the place, or a road or two going into it, because of all the rocket attacks. There was 2 days when there were 100 Qassams hitting the northern Negev with about 50 mortar shells, and Israel said, that's it, we're not going to send you all your fuel. And the Gazan leadership, Hamas, said that Israel has created a humanitarian crisis. And that's what I read. And even in Florida, in the local paper, the headline was, Israel causes humanitarian crisis.
In 2 days of cutting off their fuel supplies.
In 2 days. People are freezing to death in their homes. And the bodies in the streets piling up. I mean, the way this sounds like a concentration camp with 2 days of. And by the way, it was not an especially effective embargo. The electricity was on. Hamas turned it off. And this is the first topic I have spoke to you about, and I think we should continue, because I actually have some insight, and that's the Arabs are good at this, and the Western media play ball, and humanitarian crises always start when Israel does something, and they're all phony, and we're going to talk about one that I saw, and it's very illustrative of all of them. And that was in Lebanon. After the attack in 1982, all the papers had claimed that Israel was responsible for creating 100,000 refugees along the banks of the Hasbani and the Litani rivers. Now, as it turned out, I was in that war from the beginning. And after 3 days, I didn't pack well. I didn't even have a toothbrush. So I got a one-day pass to go back to Jerusalem, come back with clothes. And
hold that thought. Hold right there. All right. Go ahead, Barry. You went to Jerusalem to get your clothes and a toothbrush.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I took a bus to Jerusalem, and I took a bus back to where I was, which was in the Shuf Mountains, about 14, 15 miles east of Beirut, is where I was stationed. And I passed over the Litani and the Chasbani rivers. They went through, excuse me, the towns of Sidon and Tyre. Now, I looked over at the rivers. I looked at two rivers, and I took my camera out. I remember this. I brought an Instamatic to take the pictures of the war, and I took it out as we were about to cross the bridge over the Litani River, and there were no refugees. There were about 500. Okay, there were about 500 people along the shores, and I went over the Chasbani a few miles up, and there were 500 people tops. I estimated that there may have been 1,000 refugees, and there may have been less. And I said to myself, where is this figure of 100,000 refugees coming from? Where's the humanitarian crisis? Now, these cities were rubble. I mean, the downtown of these cities, very, very heavy fighting took place, and the streets were now like Roman cobblestones. They didn't have asphalt anymore, and there was that. But there was not a humanitarian crisis. The people were in their homes, and they didn't rush to the rivers. So this issue bothered me a lot, because the whole world thought that that's what we did. We caused a humanitarian crisis. And, well, I bought a Time magazine when I was back on my leave, and I read about this crisis. And then I went up, we were centered in a place by then called Endara over the Beirut-Damascus Highway, and our job was to prevent the Syrians from opening the highway and escaping, and there were reasons we were there. But none of this Time magazine was the real war. It wasn't what was happening. Now, what happened was, I was in on July 6th. I guess the convention in Jerusalem was in October or November. There was a worldwide convention on the media in Lebanon. And I had to go and see this, of course. First of all, there were big stars to see Carl Bernstein give a lecture. But the really irritating, there were a few irritating ones. Newsweek and Time were the worst. But this David Aikman was the Time bureau chief. And he went into Beirut and gave the most lying I don't believe he was in Beirut. And what he wrote was out of his fertile imagination. It wasn't even all that fertile, just his imagination. And I read the article, and he's in a Beirut hospital, and somebody walks in holding their stomach, and then they remove their hands, and their guts fall on the floor, and believe me, I've witnessed people who've been hurt, and you
hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, yeah, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry is talking about certainly the fact that during the Lebanese War in 82, when he was fighting there, and they were told about the tremendous humanitarian crisis of the people of Lebanon, and of course he had the opportunity of traveling and looking, and there was there were a few refugees, maybe 1,000 of them, but they were talking about 100,000 refugees, and the story in Time magazine was totally fraudulent. And of course it's amazing how they could always build up non-existent problems and totally ignore great humanitarian problems. For instance, when the Chinese communists starved to death between 40 and 43 million people between 1958 and 62, not a word in the American media. In fact, there's not one in probably 100,000 Americans have ever heard of the Great Famine in China between 58 and 62. And yet, here's Time magazine talking about a non-existent crisis in Lebanon. And then, of course, Barry is talking about going to a conference where there were a number of certainly leading correspondents, and of course Perry is a writer. There was a fellow there named David Aikman, who was, as I believe, senior editor for Time at the time in that region. And pick up the story there, David. Pick up the story there, Barry.
Well, he was a bureau chief, of course, and come on, a guy who's got his stomach blown open and the intestines fall on the floor is not walking.
I was right, but basically Aikman wrote about how he had seen this man coming into the hospital with his hand over his stomach. He takes his hand away, his intestines fall on the floor, and Barry is saying that, you know, he's seen more, and you get a stomach wound. I mean, you don't do anything at all. You get on a stretcher and you stay there. You certainly don't walk into the emergency room or the hospital, you know, with your hand on your stomach, and then your intestines fall out when you take your hand away. So, obviously, this is totally fraudulent journalism, but then what can you expect from Time magazine?
All of them. I mean, it was dreadful. I went to Lebanon. Every city we went in, Christian, Druze, and, by the way, Shiite Muslim. They were a little less enthusiastic, but we were pelted with candies, and we were pelted with rice. We were welcomed. I thought I was a soldier in Italy, 1944, liberating Rome. I mean, they didn't like the PLO. The PLO had turned Lebanon into a criminal state, and their lives were ruined by them, and they were glad we were getting rid of the PLO. And you couldn't find this. Now, what David Aikman said prompted me to react to a somewhat better article in Penthouse magazine, but it was still full of mistakes. Aikman tells the Assembled that, in actual fact, he's not a war correspondent, and that, truthfully, he can't tell a mink from a phantom. And I said, what is he doing in a war then? Okay, what are you doing covering a war? And Penthouse had an article that was okay compared to David Aikman, Time and Newsweek, but I wrote them a letter, and I described going over the Litani and the Chutzpani rivers. I described being pelted with candies and rice, and then I went into the reports that were fraudulent, and I said I went to this conference, and I can only conclude the reporting was so fraudulent because the reporters didn't know what they were doing. Now, today, I would report that differently, and I'm going to tell you why shortly in a way, but the point is Penthouse gave me a lot of space, and it appeared that a lot of the reporters took this letter and knew who I was. And now let us go in to the people who covered that war at the time being, and at the time. And I'm going to begin with someone who I met once, but was a close friend of my friend, Ginny Walsh, a freelance reporter, and at the same time, my friend Jenny Frey was working just secretarial, but she used it well for Time magazine, the David Aikman. And socially, I met Aikman, and I met his predecessor, Tom Kelly. He was, by the way, cited for perjury in 1988 at the Sharon libel trial in New York. But I was never amongst the foreign reporters. I was always in my own niche.
All right, fine. Well, you hang on to that thought.
Oh, I hear music.
Great. There's music, and we'll be back in just a moment with Barry Shamish. And we're talking about, certainly, the control of the media. You're not getting the truth from the media, and Barry's part of it. Worked there and knows what he's talking about. It's all controlled. We'll be back in just a moment here. No. Okay, Dr. Stan, go right ahead, Barry.
All right, so it turns out that Shipler and Thomas Friedman, who he followed Shipler, I guess Kelly was after Friedman, at the New York, no, Kelly was, it doesn't matter, it was Shipler and Friedman.
Now, these were reporters, so, these were reporters for the New York Times, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Thomas Friedman, by the way, is an actual member of the CFR, to let you know. Now, both won Pulitzer Prizes for books they had written while they were the New York bureau chiefs in Jerusalem. The Shipler book is written by a 14-year-old. It's called Wounded Spirits in the Holy Land. I have never, ever seen a book so badly written about Israel. And it won a Pulitzer Prize. And it was pushed to be on educational programs. And Friedman's book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, was at least well-written. It was just absolutely not Israel, though. Neither book was Israel. In Shipler's case, it was just so anti-Israel, it was unspeakable. And you didn't have to read with a lot of knowledge to know that he really, really had a big problem with Jews, was David Shipler. Friedman is a Jew, so let's just say you can't accuse him of having troubles with every Jew, just Jews who didn't vote Labor. Okay? That's it. Now, both of them had this view of Israel. Israel was just like Long Island, and all it had to do was get along with Queens, and the whole Middle East would be a new place with peace busting out, and it was not Israel. It was not the country I lived in. It wasn't the people I knew, and I'll get to that in 1 second. But both of them used one rabbi. They used a rabbi who is absolutely ostracized from all of other rabbis in Israel because he liked to be in the New York Times, and he pandered to them, and he knew what they want to hear, and he told them exactly what their words would have been if they were the rabbi. He simply gave a New York far-left-wing view of everything. And, well, Shipler must have left his list of sources for Friedman.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Before we go on, I want Barry to put out his website to tell you how you can get his books and to tell you how you can get his DVDs. So you go right ahead.
All righty. The website is officially the BarryChambersWebsite.com, but www.BarryChambers.com will get you there. The books, and Bye Bye Gaza is the latest and most worthy to look at. It's at Lulu, www.lulu.com. In the right-hand corner is a box, a search box. Write my name in, Chamish. That's how you spell Chamish. And now, as for, I'm going to leave a phone number because I have many DVDs, but one was just put out last week. It's the best of 2007, all my radio shows, including many with Dr. Stan, and it's fascinating to listen.
No, it's basically a CD or is it a CD-ROM?
It's an MP3, it's a DVD.
All right, fine.
I put it in my computer yesterday, it works just fine.
All right, fine.
124 shows. Well, it's 5 days of radio shows what can I say? Put it in your car. Play it while you're doing your housework. 124 shows is a lot of shows. And, by the way, not many of the other announcers are as good as you. I guess that's a backhanded plug, but it's true. And anyone who gets this will hear that. And my phone number for this is 904-501-7605. That's, once again, 904-501-7605. And I'll send it to you and a gift, maybe even a book, for $20. Now let's go back to Jerusalem. You've got these reporters. They're using the same people who give them the quotes they like. And they're producing the same book with the same point of view, and it could only be produced by someone writing for the New York Times. It has no basis in reality. In any sense, is this Israel? Is it the Middle East? It just doesn't exist, what these people wrote, and they both want Pulitzer Prizes for as an Israeli citizen who had lived there for 33 years, I assure you this was not Israel in either book. And that also leads me to the question of the Pulitzer Prizes. If two New York Times Jerusalem bureau chiefs can both get consecutive Pulitzer Prizes, you can be sure this is not a fair contest. You can be sure there are forces at work beyond what we understand for great literature and prizes given to the producers of great literature. They won, in the case of David Shipley, he won for a high school essay. Friedman, okay, he can write. But nonetheless, it goes higher up, and here's how I'm going to prove that. Now, during the Sadat visit, I worked for the Miami Sun. I was quite fortunate. I worked for someone named John Keesler, who took me on for 3 days and got some money for it, which was really important, besides the experience. And then, of course, Sadat goes back, and the Miami Sun is looking for a translator advisor for their bureau. Now, I phoned the bureau up, and I said I worked with John Keesler, and my Hebrew is quite fluent. I'd only been there a few years, but by then it was quite fluent. And he invited me, and it was very exciting, and he was excited, and he knew Keesler, and the interview went great. And then at the very end, he says to me, "Who did you vote for?" And I said, "You can't ask that." I said, "Nobody can ask a question like that. What difference does it make?" And he says, "In this office, we can ask that." And then I said I voted Likud. This was after the 77 elections. I voted for Begin. And he says, "I'm sorry, you can't work for us."
Now, for our listeners, of course, this would be corresponding to, more or less, to the conservative party of what the Republican Party used to be here in the United States. It is the Labor that's the liberal party over there. The Likud is the conservative party. Go ahead.
Well, you know, Labor might have given him pause for thought. He would have preferred the far-left party, Meretz. But if you voted Likud, which, come on, they were elected to power in Israel. The majority of Israelis supported them. What's going on here? Nonetheless, he said, "You can't work for us." And look, I mean, I don't want to hold prejudices, but this guy wasn't even American-born. He was born in Cuba. And he should understand that you're allowed different points of view, and you're allowed to be a little different. You would have thought so, but no. He says, "I'm sorry, you're not hired." And I said, "You know, this is illegal." And then he says, "Not in this office. It's not illegal in this office." And folks, I want to tell you, that was an incident that has gone on over the years. Now, the problem is I'm not capable of lying. I find it very difficult to lie, except in cases where I'm joking and it's leading to some reason, and then I'll correct myself. But to actually lie and say that I voted for a left-wing party to get the job was just not something I was terribly capable of doing, and I assume a lot of people were. I knew a lot of Israelis who ended up working for these people, and they spouted the party line, and they got the job, because if you don't spout that line, you don't work for the media in Israel. You don't work for the media in America. Maybe some local media, and maybe you'll bust out in some way, but in Israel, you will not be a foreign correspondent unless you say you voted for the most far-left party and that you want Israel and the PLO to become the best of friends, and you want to divide Jerusalem, and you want to remove Jews from Judea and Samaria. It's America. If you don't say all these things, you don't work for the foreign media. And this I found out the very, very hard way. The whole show is rigged.
Yeah, it takes a little while to realize that, and then it comes as such a shock when you realize that freedom of the press means that when you own the press, you have the freedom to distort or certainly to conceal anything you want to.
Well, I know from my experience, and it goes, well, I don't have to go through the whole thing, but I socialized at a very, very superficial level. There was one reporter there, his name was David Barrett, as recalled. He was spewing anti-Semitic stuff, and he was just a big mouth and a blabber mouth. And he married someone he met in Jerusalem, a Jewish woman. They live in America. They have a son. She's a provost of some music university somewhere. And his hatred for everything Jewish was just remarkable. I don't know really how he did this, but we'll just say he did. Now, I wanted to bring up an important issue, and that was that Olmert went to Sderot earlier in the week.
No, for our listeners, Olmert, of course, is he's the prime minister, but is that right?
Yeah, dirty mafia. Yes, he is.
No, he's the prime minister of Israel, and he goes to Sderot, which is under rocket attack.
With 100 rocket hits in 2 days.
Right.
Okay, and that's why he went, partly. These were Qassams, which are not Katyushas yet, but they caused plenty of terror in Sderot, and 10 wounded. And one company, the biggest employer of Sderot, Hollandia Mattresses, announced that they were pulling out of the city, that it was impossible to work in the city because of the rocket attacks. So Olmert shows up, and by the way, the people of Sderot apparently didn't even know he was there. It was a surprise visit.
Yeah, but
in and he was out.
Well, I think it's important for people to know that the town used to have about 24,000 people in it. Now it's got about 9,000. So certainly the majority of the people have fled the city. So here comes Olmert, and he's going to visit the city. And what did he say?
Well, first of all, the majority is proven with the IDF report the week before that 3,000 apartments are empty, deserted. In Sderot, an averaging 5 an apartment, that's 15,000 people. And also there's a program now to send Sderot children to America, and who knows for how long, because the rockets aren't going to stop tomorrow. I mean, the town is nearly a ghost town. You have about 9,000, I suppose, who really have nowhere else to live and can't afford a new house. And they're still there. I suppose they'll move with Hollandia Mattresses, 400 of them. That's how many were employed there. But what it comes down to is Olmert gives a report to the Knesset. And what a report Olmert gives, you got to move to Sderot. I mean, this town is great. It's got the lowest unemployment in the country, he announces. 3.9%. Well, if you're unemployed in Haifa, you got to move to Sderot. I mean, really, now maybe it has the lowest unemployment because there are no more people to employ in the town. You know, they're gone. He doesn't mention that. He says Sderot is holding up great. The town is just a poster town for Israel to 100 rockets in 2 days. And here's the really good news, a really good reason to move to Sderot. 70% of their high school students passed their matriculation exam. Now, which in Israel is very, very high, and he's so proud of the education. What he forgets to mention is that the teachers of the few students left taking the exam are being very, very loose and liberal with them. They're traumatized enough not to flunk out of high school. And he greets the Knesset with this report from Sterok. I mean, either guy, what it comes down to, this is the Disneyland that the poor Israelis have to live in. This is what their leader tells them is the situation in Sterok. There isn't even an ounce of reality in what he said. Not an ounce. Sterok is being bombarded with rockets. The children are totally traumatized, and a majority of the population is gone. That's the truth. What he painted is a city of endless job opportunities and great education. And that, to me, really was... Yeah, that gave it away to me. That's the kind of leadership you're getting in Israel. It's all fake.
Well, my understanding is that the reserve officers over there have called upon him to resign. In fact, I mean, he has very little support within the general population. I mean, what is his support? What percentage of the Israeli people do you think that he's
supporting? The last time was
3% support from the people. I mean, and of course, why? Because Olmert wants to give away Judea and Samaria and wants to betray the Jewish heritage. And
that's half of it. But a lot of it comes from the fact that all soldiers, including the far left, died for nothing in Lebanon, in a war where Haifa and Tiberias and Metula, they were all abandoned for 34 to 40 days. Northern Israel was abandoned because of real missiles, not Qassams, big Katyushas and Grads. And then he sent in ground troops on the last day of the war when there was no need whatsoever to send them in. You have 33 tank troops killed in one battle for no reason whatsoever. The IDF want Olmert gone. The people want Olmert gone because of the dead young men who fought in a war that Israel lost because his leadership caused them to lose it. And there's now a report on Olmert in Israel which does not recommend any harsh punishment for his behavior in Lebanon. It's called the Winograd Report, but they certainly blame his incompetence and utter stupidity for Israel losing that war. And by the way, for Israel losing that war, it's going to be rewarded with thousands upon thousands of missiles pouring on the country in the next war, and whether Israel can survive it is very, very doubtful. And my children are there, and I'm my nephew and my niece and my sister and my friends, and I try and block myself from thinking if that country goes to war, what the consequences really will be.
Well, of course, there's no such thing as a good war, and it's always as violence and horror and terror, and I share your concern, Barry.
Well, I'm more worried about another Holocaust coming out of this war, and my children are. I don't want to talk about this. I've got a sore point about all this.
Okay, fine. Well, you talk about whatever you want to. That's we're not trying to push you into it.
No, I'm worried. I mean, I've got personal worries. I'm just giving the facts here. How much time do we have?
Oh, we got about 3 minutes before we go to the break, and then 3 minutes after that.
All right, I'm going to discuss something positive, and that is the children ages 12 to 14 with 117 who were not released from jail in Israel for 14 days. They were released, and then three of them were put back in jail because they would not give their names to the police or to the judge who tried to judge them. Their crime, these 12 to 14-year-old girls, was being on a site where they want to put a so-called settlement, an outpost, and they were arrested, and these girls told the judge, we don't recognize you, we don't recognize the state of Israel as anyone capable of judging us. We will not give our names. 12-year-old girl says, I'll stay in jail rather than give you my name. Now, this was the bravest, and it was a lot braver than our army has done. Okay? If there's any hope it's in Israel, it's the fact that girls 12 to 14, seven of them, stood in jail where they were stripped naked to humiliate them, deprived of bathroom privileges. They were simply broken down, but they did not break these girls.
All right,
hold that.
Hold that thought there, Barry, and I certainly share your pride in these girls for having the ability to do what most men wouldn't do. Okay, you got 3 minutes now.
And that's my happy message.
All right, fine.
That there is still Jewish courage, and by the way, you would not know it from the performance of the political and the military scene as well. It's really battles that never took place, and now we're paying the price. But these little girls stood up proudly after they were stripped naked against their will. They were held down while they were stripped naked for only the pleasure of the guards. And they were women guards, I'm told, at least, to ogle at them. That's the only reason they were stripped. There was no need for it. But they stood up in court and refused to give their names. And they said the words that I wish every Israeli would finally say, that you are selling us down the river. You're endangering us. We may suffer another Holocaust because of you. We do not recognize the state of Israel. We want a new state. Now, if everyone stood up, including the Israeli army, which, by the way, I have said for the longest time, by not engaging in a putsch, in a coup, they're letting this go on. No man has had the courage that these girls had. And that is my, well, it's a weird a point of pride and joy, but that's it for me. That's the best news I've heard from Israel for a long, long time.
Well, I think, and I just hope and pray, that there will be enough people over there who have the courage and the integrity to stand up for the state of Israel. Because the government has been taken over. And, of course, as Barry brings out in the interviews we've done with him, Olmert is simply a tool of the CFR globalists in New York City. The same CFR globalists that control our nation and are selling us out and are using our military and financial power to bring about this one world government. And understand, these people have no loyalty to America. They are traitors. Why? Because many of them have sworn to uphold our Constitution and defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and yet they are intent upon the destruction of the sovereignty of our nation and bringing about this idea of a world government. Barry, I want to thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you, and we'll hope to talk to you again next week.
My pleasure, of course. See you then.
Bye-bye, and God bless. And Barry is a fascinating individual, a well-known writer in Israel, and we have the privilege of talking to him here as he keeps us abreast of what's going on in Israel and the betrayal of the Israeli people by their leaders, just as we are being betrayed by our leaders as well. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we really have to depend upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us. We're really involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization, and there are powerful spiritual forces which energize the leaders of the CFR globalists and the Bilderbergers and the Trilateralists and the Club of Rome and the Theosophists and the Rosicrucians and so many of the organizations, the Masons. There really are spiritual forces here. They're not imaginary. If you're a Christian, you have no alternative other than to believe that there is supernatural. What could be more supernatural than Jesus Christ being born of a virgin, or being crucified and dying and then being resurrected, or or suddenly appearing in a locked room, or the miracles that he committed at Canaan, or feeding the masses, the 5,000. I mean, if you are a Christian, you have to believe that there is a supernatural element, and certainly in Deuteronomy we're told to avoid anything of the supernatural, the mediums and the fortune tellers, and certainly the charmers, and I assume that's snake charmers, and then of course the sorcerers and the wizards and the witchcraft. And yet of course we're indoctrinating, our schools are teaching our kids about Harry Potter, and they're reading Harry Potter in schools and being introduced to witchcraft here in this country. There are powerful spiritual forces at work within our country which are energizing and controlling the minds of many of the people who are setting out our foreign policy, and our wealth and military power is being used to bring about this one world government. And that's why we're fighting over in Iraq. Why are we fighting in Afghanistan? Did you ever stop and wonder, why did we go in? Why, we went in to get Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, but they left the country, so they went into Pakistan. So why didn't we attack Pakistan? After all, we attacked Afghanistan. We're still fighting there, but we're financing Pakistan. That's financing their military, that's financing their ISI intelligence, that's financing the Taliban, who's killing our boys. And what's wrong with this picture? Well, I'll tell you what, of course, nothing as it appears to be, and you've got to start thinking and challenging everything and try to understand the truth. We do hope that many of you want to get my treatise on the Communist-Capitalist Alliance. It's very inexpensive. The Communist-Capitalist Alliance, a compilation of our newsletters, and it's based upon a talk that Solzhenitsyn gave before the AFL-CIO in 1975, where he talked about how American corporations, the American government, had helped communism since its inception, and nothing has changed. We're still funneling money, several billion dollars a year, into Russia under one pretext or another, even though they have over $440 billion in reserves, and we're having to borrow $2.5 billion a day just to pay our bills. Why would you do something like that? Well, because our leaders have a different agenda, because they march to a different drumbeat, because they dream a different dream. And we do hope that many of you, of course, will want to get the new little pamphlet we have. It's entitled The True Story of 9/11. It goes into the background of who really controls America, and of course the Council on Foreign Relations. Of course, they are a front for a secret society that was created in 1891, but nobody's ever going to tell you that. You're not going to hear that from Rush Limbaugh or from Sean Hannity or from Brian Williams. We hope that you want to get this pamphlet, The True Story of 9/11. We hope that you'll want to get our Communist-Capitalist Alliance, perhaps the book, The Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, which we do carry. And you certainly want to get my DVD of my interview with Professor Sutton, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, going into the background of how we financed the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War so they could finance the Viet Cong who were killing our boys. And just as we mentioned last hour, how we've actually given the Pakistanis the nuclear material and technology to build a nuclear weapon in preparation for what I fear is the coming war with the Muslim world. If things don't make sense, then there has to be another explanation. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America and for Radio Liberty.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.